Pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the return of the Judges Table podcast here at Rob Has a Website, Reality TV Wrap Ups. We're going to be talking about Restaurant Wars, Top Chef Season 13, Episodes 9 and 10. I'm Antonio Mazzaro. I'm joined, as always, on this podcast. We started off rough, but now we're a perfect four-person Restaurant Wars team. It's me, Antonio, Josh Wiggler, Mike Bloom, and Kurt Clark. Guys, how you doing?
Doing good. Doing good.
Doing all right.
Anyone want a cocktail?
Now I'm doing better. Now I'm good. That's what I was waiting for.
Let me pull it out. Pull it out of my computer.
I was waiting for Mike to emerge from behind a podium with like an electric yellow cocktail. Is what I needed before I could be good.
Well, thank God you're not getting judged on that response, Josh. Right?
No.
Why am I not getting judged on that response?
Yes, we're here to talk cocktails and other cock things that are in play here.
Whoa.
That the Restaurant Wars there. Listen, there were some cocky people. There were some people knocked off their perches and some unfortunate kind of goodbyes that we have to say. Although I have to say, probably not unexpected at Restaurant Wars here on Top Chef at Reality Wrap Ups here at Rob Has a Website. If you like what we're doing, you can always subscribe to our Reality Wrap Ups feed. That's robhasawebsite.com/RHAPUPS. That will get you the podcast from Top Chef, also our podcast about The Challenge, The Bachelor, and many other reality shows that we don't talk about on Rob Has a Website, Survivor, Big Brother, Amazing Race, Main Feed. So we're going to be talking about Top Chef Restaurant Wars tonight. Thank you if you're a regular listener to our podcast. If you're not a regular listener, welcome. Hopefully you enjoyed the Restaurant Wars episodes and you'll enjoy this podcast. And yeah, Mike's cocktail at the beginning here. Nice little surprise. A Bangkok Dangerous. Kurt, wasn't that a nickname of yours?
Yep, in college.
No detail there. Just nope. Just a nickname. That's just what it was.
One of many.
They called him Bangkok Dangerous. It's also a Nicolas Cage movie.
I was going to say, or was that something like...
I thought it was Dr. Evil.
Yeah, that's sort of my like obligatory Nicolas Cage Dr. Evil slash my father voice that I use when I'm impersonating.
Sounds a little bit like Don Knotts too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a little bit.
They called me Bangkok Dangerous.
Oh, Andy,
yeah, I should have known it by the kids. They called me Bangkok Dangerous.
I just don't. We're going to have to get into this whole cocktail and popping up from behind the podium and everything that is the glory of Philip. We also have to eulogize Philip because, spoiler alert, newsflash, top story here, the victim of Restaurant Wars is Philip. No more Chef Philip on Top Chef. Josh, any words of eulogy for Chef Philip?
Yeah, no nopes this time. I would start by saying the victim of Restaurant Wars. I would question that premise because he was the star. You know, we've been waiting for so long. We've been talking about Restaurant Wars for the past few weeks, begging to the high heavens for Philip to make it at least that far. And I'm so glad he did. Because he provided so much entertainment. He provided exactly what we wanted him to provide. It was a disaster. It was a catastrophe. It was incredible. Thank you, Philip, for everything. Now, I hope your hand is better. That's my eulogy for Philip. He did everything we needed him to do. It was a perfect, perfect way for Philip to leave Top Chef.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about it before recording. It was a little bit of a fake out because I think watching the first half of Restaurant Wars, you were like, Philip seems like he's doing okay, but he was full on Philip for the back half.
Strawberries and onions, ladies.
Strawberries and onions, but also showing off his tattoos and talking about his restaurants like they're his children, which is absolutely fantastic. You have to love the irony of during Restaurant Wars, Philip going around to diners, making small talk, talking about his other two restaurants.
I love when Tom was like, I guarantee you he's not talking about this restaurant. And it just cuts him being like, yeah, my other restaurants are really cool.
Dr. Evil Philip again. Yeah. It's Josh's dad, Dr. Evil Philip voice. Nicolas
At my
Cage
restaurant,
voice.
We serve liquid magma.
That's good.
Yes. Honestly, Is the liquid magma too vinegary? Is it a vinegary taste for the liquid magma, or is it too? Is it in a foam?
It's in a foam, and it tastes like a salt bomb.
Oh yeah. Boy! Yeah. Well, I have something else that we can talk about. That's like that. Kwame will not be happy when we get to that. But yeah, so much to talk about here on the Restaurant Wars episode. Not only episode, but episodes. We didn't talk last week. You didn't miss a podcast. There was no elimination. last week since we did the two-part Restaurant Wars with the lunch and dinner service. So we're going to talk about both episodes here today. And really, the first is sort of anticlimactic in light of what we know from the second. But it is interesting to revisit the first episode, knowing what we now know about the second episode. So we're going to get right into that. In fact, the first episode starts with Chef Isaac saying, like, losing has lit a fire under me. If you'll recall, when we last left Chef Isaac, he had almost lost and been eliminated because of his dry sausage at the beefsteak, which you never want to have. So he really mocks. He says, you know, I see what's winning. It's crudos. It's Asian flavors. My food isn't tweezified. So he's sort of mocking the sort of things that have won before. And I think these words are interesting. I don't know if this was filmed, this confessional was filmed before Restaurant Wars or after. Anybody have any takes on that? Because he's very clearly setting up, I feel like, what some of the fundamental issues with Restaurant Wars are and giving himself his own narrative here in a very positive way.
These were really interesting two episodes for Isaac, because I feel like his narrative throughout the past eight episodes before this were, this guy's a good chef, but he's very unfocused. He's not very meticulous with his work, which, you know, a lot of these other chefs that come from other types of restaurants really are, specifically through their training. But Isaac was able to not only, you know, come back from being picked last, most certainly because of that reason, he was able to successfully lead his team and net a win. It's interesting looking at, like, our eight chefs overall over these two episodes. I would say the only two that really came out with pluses under their names were Isaac and Marjorie. I feel like everyone else had a moment or two where they did not make good food these past two episodes. But Isaac, for someone that is apparently, you know, so anti the Top Chef rhetoric, because that he doesn't tweezify everything, like, is one of the cardinal rules of this show. For someone who lives by that lifestyle, he was able to make a pretty good name for himself, and he came away with a win, his first win, and he's thrilled about that. And it also kind of brings up the question of what does this the future hold for Isaac? You know, do we think that Isaac has a, I know we talked about winners at it beforehand, but do you think Isaac's sort of in contention here, or do you think he's still kind of on the bottom of our possible winners moving forward?
Josh, I mean, you drafted yourself, or we now share a team with Isaac as kind of the centerpiece of it. What are your thoughts on Isaac? I'm curious, because I know you're a big Marjorie fan, and we've also got Jeremy on our team. But Isaac was really, he was my hammer. I really liked Isaac from the jump, and he was my top draft pick. You were not around for that. You had a robot living your life.
Yeah, a robot.
But you had a robot living your life. But I am curious how you feel about Isaac here after Restaurant Wars.
I love Isaac. I thought that Isaac had an incredible two episodes, and I thought that he had a really strong episode, at least narratively, in the first one before the second one even aired. I do think that those confessionals were recorded after the result. We see when he wins and he's just bursting with energy, like he's like, I won! He'd been containing that the whole time, and he had that energy that was firing up his confessional, so you knew that that was the result. I think that this is great for Isaac, and I think that Isaac has been getting a lot of, you know, we've been noting it. He'd been getting a lot of sass from, I think it was Marjorie in confessional, saying things like, Isaac lacks subtlety, Isaac isn't ready for this. And I think we saw Isaac, who had, you know, suffered at beefsteak, he ended up being the backbone for this group. He was picked last, but he knows what's up in the restaurant business, and he was great. He was positive. He was a great unifier. He was cooking well. So this kind of challenge is where he excels. And I think from a narrative point of view, it was huge, huge points. Once he's completely left to his own devices again, I wonder how that's going to go. I wouldn't say slam dunk victory for this guy or anything, but I think if we're looking, and we don't typically do this because I think one of the strengths of Top Chef is that it doesn't really lean on this too much. But if we were looking at the story for people who would be considered front runners to win, I think after Restaurant Wars, you got to consider Isaac pretty close to the top next to somebody like Marjorie or maybe even Karen.
Yeah, Kurt, I was going to ask you. Josh said that, you know, Marjorie and Isaac kind of walked away from Restaurant Wars the clear winner favorites. But what about Karen? Karen is on your team. And I think Karen had a pretty good Restaurant War. She certainly cooked a great dish with the steak dish. She took on a lot. Her front of house service was good. Where do you see Karen's chances here after the Restaurant Wars episodes?
I thought it was interesting because at the very beginning, you do have the conversation between Karen and Marjorie about, you know, they're the only two women left, but, you know, there's some, get some positive lady juju going in terms of like who's going to potentially win. But as I would actually disagree with the statement earlier that that Karen came out of this basically unscathed. I think, yes, in terms of the food, but in terms of taking on too much, in terms of Marjorie doing her front of house training for her and Isaac having to step in and help with her dishes. I think that while she came through unscathed, I also think that it's potentially indicative of her continuing to take on too much moving down the road. So I'm actually a little less bullish on Karen than I was going into this over the last couple of weeks, where I thought she's been doing amazing. I'm just hoping she kind of reins things in and gets things under control, because not everything's going to be a team challenge where you're going to have people who are there to help you.
Yeah, and it is fascinating because we know that Karen, I mean, the first thing we see Karen really in the first episode is her talking about her James Beard nomination, the fact that she's missing the Beards that night to be on Top Chef. And so we know Karen is a really high-talented, high-quality chef. And yet we also know that Isaac's been nominated for a James Beard Award. She's not the only James Beard Award nominee in the cast. So and there are others as well. So she does stand out from the pack a lot of the time with really good food. But you're right. The decision-making is a little bit questionable here. And I think, Josh, what you're saying is that the decision-making for Isaac is really where he got a chance to shine. This is not him, being left to his own devices. This is him doing what he does in Toop's Meadery every day, running a restaurant, putting his ego in check, doing all those things. And I think, Josh, as you and Mike are saying, like, I do think that that really comes to shine. But I mean, we only have to look as far as the beefsteak to see how quickly fortunes can turn on this season of Top Chef, because Philip won the beefsteak. Like, he came out of that confident.
I'll say one by default, because everyone else either misinterpreted the challenge or, in Isaac's case, did not make good food. So
don't take anything away from Philip's yummy food, okay? It was yummy.
It's fine, because Philip's going to disregard anything negative that's said about his dishes anyway.
Executed perfectly. They just didn't like it.
Exactly.
But we've seen repeatedly people win one challenge and go home the next week. I'm thinking specifically of Grayson. We talked about this earlier in one of the podcasts. How did we think it was a redemption story for Grayson, given that she was at the bottom and then she won? Then the very next episode, she ends up going home, and the exact sort of same thing happens potentially to Philip. And that pattern of losing one win, which is a potential redemption, and then going home, I'm wondering if Isaac does fall into that pattern as well.
Yeah,
well, the interesting thing about Restaurant Wars is that it's pretty unmitigated in terms of typical Top Chef fare. Yes, there's so many more factors added on in terms of you need to think about everything behind a pop-up restaurant, but there's no sort of challenges where it says like you need to cook in the dark and you can only use foods that are purple. And so I think where Isaac has sort of suffered, specifically the past 2 weeks before this, when he was in the bottom, was just fitting his food into those types of challenges. And so I do agree with you guys that once we get back to those types of challenges, and it seems like from the preview, we're going big grand scale, and I'll leave it at that to avoid spoiling anything. This could be a probable sticking point for him, because yes, Isaac's great at just basically running a restaurant and making restaurant quality food, but when he has to put that restaurant quality food back under the constraints of a Top Chef challenge, that's where he might falter again.
Yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting is we've been talking a lot on these podcasts about how this is a really fun season because it's a level playing field and people are competing, on a similar level. There's like no obvious front runner. Everyone's really, really talented and good. And I think that Restaurant Wars is a really difficult challenge. They observe it in this episode where it's like you're being asked to do in 24 hours what most people do in like a year. Right. It's a difficult, difficult challenge, but I think we saw the seams in a lot of these people this week. I think it was a really unflattering look for a lot of people, and we're, we're praising Isaac right now, but I think Mike, you're pointing out very, fair weaknesses in his game and his abilities that could come up later on down the road. So I think I just walked away from this episode greatly entertained, loved this episode, but I was kind of questioning this, this sort of notion that, what's the spell with the fiction that these guys know exactly what they're doing? They don't know exactly what they're doing. Some of these chefs, I feel like there was a little bit of the weaker sides of some of these chef testants came out this week. And I'm a little less sturdy with some of these people moving forward. That's exciting, but I think that it's just a little bit of a reversal after Restaurant Wars than maybe where we were before it.
Yeah, we'll talk about all that because there is some shine that's knocked off of people, especially someone like Jeremy. Amar doesn't have the best day. We talked about Karen. So we'll get into the nuts and bolts of all that over the course of these two episodes. But I definitely agree with the general consensus here. Even though I'm in the tank for Isaac, he has not done well in the kind of let's cook. I'm like, whatever, Mike, your Don Pardo does Top Chef announcing challenges voice was.
You have to cook using a bow and arrow.
Yeah, so you know, like he hasn't done well in those kind of silly what is the sort of hallmark of Top Chef, but here we get to Restaurant Wars and where it's all about doing the work of a chef. Isaac knocks it out of the park. Not surprising, he's run his own restaurant for a really long time. He has the right attitude. His maturity level in that regard is very high, so good for him. It is fun and interesting to kind of see Kwame in this environment as well, because as we see at the beginning of the episode, Kwame's making calls to his business partner. They're still talking about getting their restaurant started in DC. So the whole, like, let's generate a concept and let's menu plan and let's get the design elements down. And how about the front of house and how are we going to do service and on and on and on. These are all things that are on Kwame's mind as a professional, not just as a chef testing on Top Chef. So I thought that was a really good little slide in at the beginning here. Then we get the Restaurant Wars song. What do you guys feel? I mean, anybody have a hot take on the Restaurant Wars song? My question only is, do you guys feel like Top Chef needs to shake up where they do Restaurant Wars? Everybody knew it was coming. The contestants knew it was coming such that they had planned a song to sing when they got into the kind of warehouse kitchen that day. Are you guys okay with Top Chef being so clearly, I mean, Survivor, the merge can shift, so it's not 100% clear when there's going to be a merge, and players kind of play the game sometimes incorrectly, assuming a merge is coming. But everyone knows 8 people left Top Chef Restaurant Wars. Any issues with that, anybody?
I'm fine with it being at 8. I don't have a problem with it. I did think the song was terrible, though.
Listen, for 8 people that are not musically inclined as their career, I thought they did an okay job. It's also funny when they pan across the line and you can tell, like, some people are in it a lot more than other people. Isaac, for example, is just sort of like in the back, like tapping his foot, but Kwame is like getting it on there. But me thinks that
it's his chance to impress Padma, you know.
That's true. Yeah. Padma, I'm composed an ode to you and your style of Restaurant Wars.
Yeah, yeah, except I don't know.
It was not okay. It was horrible. Yeah. Never do that again.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't know about the impression part, because I think one of the biggest issues here is you're taking Padma's big moment away from her. And she tries to kind of joke about it and say, oh, sorry, it's not Restaurant Wars. Just kidding.
Yeah, she double pastored them.
She did. She repastored them.
The only thing worse than the song was Padma's attempt at a fake out. I was like,
that was bad.
It was like, just kidding. I'm like, no.
I kind of wanted her to say, like, oh, it's not Restaurant Wars. And then Bill Chait's like, no, it is Restaurant Wars, Padma. We it just says that on the call sheet. And then just completely undo her attempt at a joke.
Yeah. I got to imagine that Bravo and the people, you know, who create Top Chef, I think that they loved that TV moment. I think that it was a good TV moment for them. And I think that there's no problem with Restaurant Wars being at 8. I think that there's something great about having these contestants knowing, like, almost being able to, like, put in their calendar when Restaurant Wars is, so they can already start, you know, kind of generating ideas. It's a tradition, you know, it's the great Top Chef tradition, is you get this far, it marks the halfway point of the season, it's essentially the end of Act One, and now the rest of Top Chef can happen. I think that there's nothing wrong with having Restaurant Wars be kind of a sturdy fixture in the season, because even if you can plan for it, even if you know that you have Restaurant Wars coming up so solidly that you can come up with this absurd song and sing it on national television, that's not going to prepare you for the danger of this competition, as we saw with everyone on Amar's team just completely falling apart and other people falling apart as well. So I have no problem with it being a fixture on the show. I think that it's probably a really good thing, actually.
Yeah, I think that there is plenty of opportunity to play with the format of Restaurant Wars if you want some sort of shift or twist, like they did these two episodes. I'd almost rather see what's this season's take on Restaurant Wars than losing it or moving it to another time to try to fool the
right
world.
Agreed.
I think the only time I'm trying to remember that they really moved Restaurant Wars was, I think, in season 4 they did Wedding Wars at 8 and then they did Restaurant Wars at 6. I believe. They might have also done Restaurant Wars at 6 and all. No, they did that at 8 as well. So it's pretty much been a fixture. I mean, if it was the same people every year, I could totally understand it becoming trite or tripe, as it will, in putting it at the same time period at every point in the season. But as we're about to see, I think Bravo has its own ways of shaking up Restaurant Wars enough to make it feel new every time.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm trying to remember, I thought there was a season, and I could be wrong about this, but in season 10 where Kristen got eliminated, was that, I felt like there were uneven Restaurant Wars teams.
There was. Then. So basically what happened was the two people won. I think it was Kristen and Sheldon, I want to say, the really chill guy with the beanie.
Oh, sure.
They got to pick teams right at the elimination, like right at judges table after the previous elimination challenge, and then they basically said, oh, so then we're going to eliminate one person, and so teams will be uneven from the start. It happened to be the boys versus girls lineup, but yeah, I think they started off, not, I don't remember if that was at 10 or 8, but I do remember that the girls started off with an upper hand, but they had Josie, so that was probably actually a lower hand and a handicap from the
game.
You
don't say that name here anymore.
Yeah, I remember that being kind of a key part of it, and yeah, I think there were 7. I think there were 4 women and 3 men, and one of the men was Stefan, and he was there with Sheldon. I think Josh was on that. I'm trying to remember some of the other people, but that was one of the recent seasons where I remember the Restaurant Wars kind of thing being a little bit different. And it seems like they have in the past played with it a little bit.
In the past, I was trying to remember, did they usually also do a quick fire challenge where there was somebody on one of the teams that was immune?
They sometimes do it.
Okay. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, they sometimes, I think in the first stages of Restaurant Wars, they do like quick fire challenges beforehand, and sometimes the winner will like pick their team and the other team. They change it up every time, but this is, as of late, they just sort of skip the frills of the quick fire challenge and just say, okay, we're going to designate an entire hour, or in this case, 2 hours to Restaurant Wars overall.
And I guess the second question to that, Kurt, I throw this to you first. How do you feel about deciding the teams by a schoolyard pick'em, where you draw the knives and two chefs get to kind of settle the teams out and really kind of draw a line about where people feel they're most comfortable with each other, maybe where people in this case feel about the quality of a chef? I mean, Isaac is picked last, and that adds a lot to the narrative. Do you feel like it adds anything to the game at all, the schoolyard pick'em? Is this the best way to determine Restaurant Wars teams?
I'm fine with, see, this is, I think, one of those things they could potentially switch up from season to season, because I do think that if they know that Restaurant Wars is coming at 8, and they can potentially even start to plan out their teams and menus and restaurant concepts ahead of time. If you have a team of 4 in mind and 2 of the 4 end up as team captains, that's going to spoil your plans a little bit. But I was fine with it for once, but I don't mind then, like, maybe so to avoid that next season, have it be completely random, or have there be some sort of Iron Chef like element where they do have to incorporate one item assigned by the other team into each of your dishes, or to star at your restaurant, or something to basically switch it up so they can't plan too much. But I was fine with it happening this time.
Yeah, I do like it. I do like that you get the kind of sense, and we get a cutaway, which is not present, of course, in the game, of Amar saying, you know, I think Isaac is a better chef than Philip, but I'm really just picking Philip because he wanted to do front of house, and I don't want to do that. So there is some gamesmanship going on, but the chef testants don't necessarily know that. Maybe Amar told Isaac that, maybe he didn't, but it does seem to light a fire under Isaac, like, pick me last and see what happens. And we do get the great kind of, vowing of revenge. You've made a mistake, Isaac says. So I like that kind of the schoolyard pick'em does give us these narrative elements that really start to come into play. And where you can, in a season like this, this was a perfect outcome. The person picked last ends up going on to be the dominant kind of force on one of the teams and as a leader and ends up winning the challenge. So I think that it's great to do the pick'em that way, because you've got this sort of built-in stories there. But mm-hmm. I don't know. You're right. Shaking it up is not ever a bad thing. And Top Chef continues to do that, I'm sure.
Well, let's talk about shakeups, because this is when Padma announces that Restaurant Wars is bigger and better than ever. As we talked about before, it is lunch and dinner services this year. And I would just love to get your guys' thoughts, maybe from a results-oriented perspective, since obviously we've seen both episodes at this point. Was it a change you feel was necessary, and did you like the results overall? Because I think the complaints that a lot of people had after the first episode specifically was, why are we extending this into two episodes? And I think it was nice to really see the bro alliance kind of fall apart in episode two, as much as it sort of hits the heart of my team. But I don't know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around, was it worth it to do two full weeks of Restaurant Wars in the middle of the season?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I like the double-sized Restaurant Wars. Like, I like the double-sized competition. I like that they do lunch service and dinner service. I think that's a fun new twist on Restaurant Wars. But I would have liked a two-hour episode. Like, I would have liked to have watched that all in one shot, as opposed to broken up over 2 weeks. I think that I do still take issue with the breaking it up over two episodes. I thought that the first one on its own and in its own week was a little bit thin. But if you combine that with the second episode, it's, you know, one of the great jam-packed, basically television movie events of Top Chef. So I liked it in concept. I don't know that I loved it in execution in terms of how they paced out the episodes.
Interesting. Well, see, I kind of had interpreted the question as, did it need to be, like, you know, 2 hours long? I mean, I agree. I could have done what they solid 2 hour chunk. I didn't have a huge issue with it being broken up over two episodes, but I do definitely feel that it needed 2 hours. I don't think this was something
right.
We could have done in 1 hour.
Yeah, if it was like a special 2 hour episode of Top Chef, like, I'm good with that. That's great. Yeah. And that's an event and that gets you excited. But who's ever excited over, like, yeah, two part Restaurant Wars where you know you're not going to get any kind of conclusion in the first one and you're going to have wait a second week?
Especially since, like, I know we'll probably talk about how the way the first episode ended in a little bit, but usually I wanted the episode to end in a bit of, I'd compare it to, like, in The Apprentice, what they used to do with the final tasks is that they'd sort of do like a two part episode where they started in one episode and finished during the live finale. And at the end of the first episode, they try to create sustainable cliffhangers for both teams. It'll be like, on one team, oh no, we got the wrong camera angles for our commercial. And for the other one, like, oh no, it's supposed to rain on our big outdoor celebrity charity picnic, so that you could feasibly want to tune in the next week to see, like, oh, okay, I hope everyone solves their problems. Here at the end of the first hour, it seems like Palette's totally fine and District LA is understandably completely bombing. And so I'm not exactly wanting to tune in if I'm a casual viewer the next week, because I know, like, oh, Palette's most likely going to win. I can't see any feasible way that Palette should lose this, because right. District just seems like a hot mess.
Yeah. Would you guys prefer seeing, like, a lunch service and then we're going to eliminate one chef? Go ahead.
I was thinking the same things. Like, that would have been potentially an interesting way to do it, is to still have an elimination after the first service, but your team has to go full steam ahead for dinner, now a person down. Although I don't know if that just then builds, like, the increased likelihood that they're just going to lose a second time.
Could you imagine if Philip got eliminated and they still had to make his stupid strawberry salad soup?
Yeah.
Even with him gone?
I got news for
the menu's been the menu's been printed.
Yeah, it would have been better. I think it would have been better because,
oh yeah, Kwame had ideas.
Kwame had ideas, and other people had weighed in on what the problems with that dish were. So I don't know, but it is interesting because a lot of ideas do get shouted down. This is the kind of point in the episode where we see Isaac throwing a lot of ideas at his team about things. I can make a cornbread. I can do a cheese plate. And they're not saying yes to any of them. Marjorie, in fact, seems to be just not having any of it. Josh, did you like Marjorie in this moment?
I love Marjorie in all the moments. I thought Marjorie was great this episode in every moment. And, like, when she's just, like, given the sass, I love Marjorie. So yeah, I loved her in this moment. I thought she was great.
Yeah. Vince Mancini at UpRocks has taken to calling Marjorie Missabella, like, that's his nickname for, or Mike Missabella, either way, that she's bringing the sass and she's bringing the kind of negative comments, but also cooking good food. And I don't think she's gone full Isabella, but
no.
Yeah, she is very funny.
I feel like that's an insult. I don't want to compare her to Mike Isabella.
She's in the moment. She doesn't want clunky food. She is stepping up and kind of taking a little bit of control of the menu planning at Palette. And Isaac, to his credit, is saying, I got to put myself in check. Got to get the ego back there. You know, we don't want those feelings going into the challenge. We're going to lose if we clash egos. That's the easy way for a loss. So Isaac, I think, very clearly telling the story of why he was successful in this challenge, and in part why his team was successful, because they all did seem to put their egos in check and do it in service of winning the challenge. They call their restaurant Palette, which I think is fine. It's a non-threatening, harmless name. And then we get it.
Unless you have, like, you know, past experiences with a palate expander, in which case.
Yeah, or you have, like, a cleft palate.
Yeah, and you're like, no!
Or you ate all of your food off of, like, one of those artist's palates, you know, right. Like Bob Ross uses. So that would be bad as well.
Yeah, like when you were a kid, you just, like, ate all the paint and you had to go to the hospital.
Or you really hated the first town in the Pokemon franchise. That could be it.
Digging deep for that one, Mike. Digging deep for that one.
Oh, but it was good. It scored with me.
I got nothing. I got Out nothing.
Down, baby. Yeah, topical. Well, Pokemon Red and Blue. Which one are you, Mike? Are you a red or are you a blue?
I'm a Squirtle person, so I'm more blue than red.
Yeah. Got to go Pokemon are. Blue. It's not even a question.
Kurt, be careful. Don't go full bloom.
Sorry, I almost did. Well, I was surprised.
Oh, Mike's a Squirtle. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we talked about how, I mean, to what extent Marjorie, like Isaac, as they all step back, Marjorie is like shooting things down. I was surprised the extent to which Kwame and Philip seem to be butting heads during the prep for the challenge. First from seat choice to mason jar choice to, I was just very surprised by all that.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I feel like it's interesting, because I don't think we saw really any conflict between Kwame and Philip in previous episodes. I mean, when everyone sort of gang piled on Philip a few episodes ago, specifically Jason, I feel like Kwame was sort of, granted he was in the bottom, so he was just sort of there, but I feel like he was, you know, he's been helping Philip out. It seemed like they had a camaraderie going, but no, it seemed like the two of them were like two dogs fighting at it this entirety of two episodes. Maybe Kwame just thinks like Philip has no idea what he's talking about, so I'm going to try to help him. I also do love that when their team is coming up with their name, Philip completely lampshades the restaurant business by saying, we need a name that doesn't actually mean anything. So let's choose a District 16.
Yeah, which I think Kwame pointed out, or Omar, that was a great film.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it sounds like the sequel to that Neil Blomkamp movie.
Oh, Elysium.
Yep, the sequel to Elysium.
No, wrong one. We don't talk about Elysium.
Chappie.
We don't talk about Elysium. We do not talk about Chappie ever.
Elysium would have been a better restaurant name.
What were some of their rejected?
Chappie would have been bad. We don't want to go to Chappie.
What were some of their rejected names? Some of the ones that they were throwing out that were rejected were pretty embarrassing, I felt like, or just not good restaurant names at all. They settle on District LA, which is not great, as we're observing. But I don't know. You're right. They did butt heads, Mike, and there is a lot going on there. And we see it manifest not only in the mason jars and the menu planning, but also in the kind of difficulty of communication between Kwame and some team members. Two of the team members have to go to Restaurant Depot to get like proteins and like larger scale bulk order kind of things. And then two of the team members are like a Whole Foods place where they're getting the kind of nuts and bolts, you know, smaller ingredients that keep things together in their dishes. And Kwame was having problems locating bacon. This was the big drama of the first episode. Kwame can't find bacon at the Restaurant Depot and is telling Omar like, hey, I need bacon. And Omar apparently has a bad phone connection and doesn't hear the bacon thing. Is that what happened?
I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But then later on, when they don't get the bacon, Kwame somehow blames Jeremy for it.
Yeah.
And Jeremy was not having any of that, which was, it's like, I don't, Jeremy, watching Jeremy's journey over the course of this episode kind of amazed me. Like, he went from being that cheerleader, like he'd be a great motivator on the team, would love to have Jeremy on the team, to just completely like spiraling into frustration and out of control. But at least, I mean, and I think that was one of the tipping points where he's like, yeah, you know what? I'm here to motivate, but you know what? Don't you dare effing tell me that you told me to get something and you never did.
Yeah, I'm really hard thumbs down on Jeremy right now after this episode. I think that I don't know about you guys, I got severe douche chills from Jeremy throughout this episode.
Now Jeremy's going to tweet me saying that I said that he had douche chills. We're going to have another Adam situation. I know. Josh.
Yeah, good job saying that, Mike. That idea originated from you.
There are actually a couple of people out there. There's a small contingency of the RHAP audience that sometimes get confused when you and I are on the same podcast because they say we sound alike.
What? That's some vague anti-Semitism going on.
Very vague.
I just get so confused by their New York sensibilities.
Now that's some like overt anti-Semitism.
Ted Cruz, I didn't know you were on the podcast.
Oh god. Steer the ship away, Antonio.
Yeah. So I don't understand these people. Kurt, you seem shocked by this news, but I'm with you. I'll put my neck on this one and blame it on Mike later. I agree with you, Josh. That's
at a Mike Bloom type.
Yes,
on Twitter.
Yeah. Thoughts and comments too. At a Mike Bloom type.
Yeah.
But I agree. Yeah. This is a not a great couple of episodes for Jeremy. He's already kind of towed the line between, as Mike is saying, like a, you know, a sports team kind of rah-rah kind of guy and a bro. He is a bro.
He is a bro.
And this is the very negative part of that coming out. Like, and I, you know, I mentioned this earlier, that what the Uproxx, what Vince Mancini, he's nicknamed all the contestants. Some of them are better than others, but he's calling Jeremy frat dad now. I'm not sure exactly why he's a dad, but this is,
I know exactly why he's a dad, because he's that guy who had the really cool hair when he was in his rock band in college that never went anywhere, and now the hair is all gone and he's got dad bod and he's a hot dad, so he's frat
strong
dad.
Take Mike, strong take. going really well Mike Bloom, really enjoyed it. So yeah, no, that I think that's partially true, and you know, this is the thing. Jeremy is slapping butts like he's on a sports team in the kitchen, like he's really heard that, like he says it several times. So I
beast mode Jeremy,
he's doing like the kind of like, I'm trying to stay above water here. But you're right, Kurt, the really interesting thing is that switch gets flipped when Kwame is mentioning the bacon. Jeremy gets very angry in that moment, and we see a little bit of a different side of him. So I mean, look, some of this I think we have to chalk up to the stress is wearing on the chefs. I mean, Marjorie doesn't have her best moment, even though we love it, when Carl is calling her in the kind of between Restaurant Depot and Whole Foods, saying, this is what I need you to find for my dish at Whole Foods. She cannot handle Carl throwing all these items at her. And it's like, oh, I'll call you back. You know, she just does not like the way her type A kind of need to organize my shopping list mentality is jibing with Carl just throwing a million things at her. So nobody's having the best time here. It's very stressful. Marjorie, in fact, says she thinks she's going to punch faces that night. Which is great. So that is that's really happening. And then when they get back, Kwame is very upset about the no bacon for the soup. We get that. I think it's funny. I laughed really hard the second time, especially that when this fight is going down, Amar is not saying anything. Nothing.
Nope.
Yep. No, Amar has a very simple philosophy for the entirety of Restaurant Wars, which is basically like, he has the Vesepri Atari route of like, I'm staying out of the drama. Like, you guys can sink your ships all you want to. I'm just going to be on my own little island doing what I need to.
Yeah, so we have that. I mean, Amar is prepping food like that. We have this sort of prep sequence where they're doing a lot of the prep. Karen is making her tortellini the night before. They're doing the lunch and dinner prep and getting kind of the main things done. Jeremy talks about making risotto at this point and how he's going to make it the night before. It's kind of a red flag. I know fans of the Top Chef series, when someone makes risotto on Top Chef, it's usually not going to go well. It's hard to kind of think about times when it has gone well. I don't know why he makes this choice, but it seems like, to me, right away, a red flag.
Well, especially when he says in the judges table, I don't make risotto in my restaurant. And I feel like risotto is also getting a reputation from Hell's Kitchen as like the one thing that nobody can ever make right for Gordon Ramsay either. So I feel like why, like, I understand that district has sort of taken a more cultural perspective of their menu to say like, let's just make what we want and we'll put it under the broad umbrella of California culture. But Jeremy, this shouldn't be like the first thing, like, oh yeah, go to gotta make risotto, that's like that's my trademark dish, because it's very clear that not only does he never make it, he doesn't make it well at all.
Yeah, and he doesn't even make it, I mean, the traditional prep way, and it comes out pretty quickly that wasn't a great call. He doesn't make it with broth or any kind of stock,
right,
which adds
he
flavor.
He boils it like pasta, basically. Yeah. You know,
that doesn't make a ton of sense. So there's a lot of that discussion going on here in this prep phase. And one of the kind of things that if you're watching it again, knowing the ending, we do have a sequence here where Jeremy is saying, Philip, is your salad dressing too thick? And Philip says, no, I want it to coat the plate. And Kwame's like, I think it needs salt. You know, they're already weighing in, even during the prep phase, about the salad dressing. Of course, we see a large kind of discussion of how Philip wants his salad made. And they're all, the rest of his team are all pushing back on this. They say, simplify your dish. You know, Philip just says, work harder. This is exposing cracks in the bro alliance. Isaac actually has a confessional where he says, we're going to let the bros take themselves down. I'm happy to have the girl power on my team. These bros are just going to, you know, out bro each other over here. And I think we do see that in the kind of scenes where they're disagreeing about dishes and butting heads. Philip is sort of writing his own, you know, elimination ticket here by saying work harder and coming up with a really complex dish and then not taking feedback on it and not asking other people to work on it. That's a dish that he serves at his restaurant. Do you guys feel like this is a good idea when you have a dish that you've done well and has been well received at your restaurant that you find a way to kind of shoehorn it into Restaurant Wars? Because clearly this has been a successful dish for Philip, but it did not go well at all here. What's the disconnect?
Isaac has the right philosophy. Isaac's philosophy is like everything has to have a theme. Like there, it has to be coherent within, you know, the dishes. They all have to feel like they're part of the same place. Otherwise, it's just going to be all over the map. And so for Philip to, you know, introduce like little ingredients from his restaurant that works in the past, that's not going to jive with anybody else. So hard thumbs down to that approach.
I also love that Philip brings this up in part two, but apparently this dish was named by a Pulitzer Prize winning chef as one of like the dishes to try in LA. And I might be ignorant on the Pulitzer Prizes. Do chefs win the Pulitzer Prize?
Maybe they're writing a cookbook.
I just think it's some random like, oh yes, I won the Pulitzer Prize in economics. This salad looks pretty good. I guess you could have it.
They win the poo poo platter Itzer Prize. Sorry, I thought it worked in my head and it did not come out.
It's
as well
it's a good try, Mike. It was a good try. So yeah. No problem there.
Thanks, Antonio. It's me, Mike. The joke that
it keeps on giving.
This is how identity theft starts, guys.
With a podcast,
the movie.
Oh, the movie.
No spoilers, man.
Yes, Melissa McCarthy impersonates Jason Bateman's voice, and that's how it starts. And then Neil Blomkamp comes in.
Well, hopefully she doesn't do it with a douchey LA accent, which is something that Isaac's wife is worried that Isaac is going to pick up. I laughed at this. Isaac's wife, hilarious. Their story. Yeah. Isaac says we met during my one semester of college, and you know, there he says, "I guess I'm getting soft, but I'll shank you." You know, this is just great. Classic. Isaac here, and you know, that
moment was really good. There was just like a look in his eye of like determination, and it was like you could see if this was Top Chef Restaurant Wars the movie, that this was the main character of the movie. Like this was the guy that you want to be watching.
Yeah, but go ahead.
And it's interesting because I'd say overall, I think now that Philip's gone, I think Isaac is pretty much the only quote unquote character left on this. I know Marjorie has her Isabella moments, but I feel like Isaac is the only like true blue character we have left on the show now that Philip's gone.
Yeah, and we get a lot of Isaac as a character, of course, throughout his confessionals here. He has the great one pretty much right away after these kind of moments where they're talking about prep, where he's talking about his leadership style. And he says, I'm going to lead and I will make you like me and I'll make you fear me, but I'll make you like me first and you'll fear me second. And so he's giving his kind of leadership philosophy there. I think a decent leadership philosophy. I think we kind of see that play out a little bit in the lunch service. There's great stuff going on because here we are, they're prepping for the lunch service. Karen's making a great steak salad. She's already behind on prep though. Isaac's trying to get Carl to help. Carl is making what looks like cat food, but there's apparently a terrine. does not look good, but he's making this pate or this terrine, and he's running out of time. Everybody's kind of in the weeds a little bit, even at the beginning. Marjorie's telling the front of house staff to turn the tables very quickly during lunch. She's making it very clear from the start that they've got to get the service over and done. And their goal is to get people out in 45 minutes. Service does start. Marjorie's kind of starting the service by saying, I'm concerned about Isaac as a GM. And Isaac says she's got her frowny face on, but that frowny face wins challenges. I don't know. I feel like the editing of this, they're trying to introduce that Palette may have a rough lunch service and that Isaac might not do very well. But that sort of thing is gone pretty quickly. This is not the narrative about Palette at all. So I'm not sure why they played around with the editing there. Maybe it was just to let our jaws hit the floor when Padma walks in wearing that dress.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I came out of the first episode thinking that things were pretty evenly matched. Like, I didn't think that it was necessarily a narrative. Well, I should say for most of the episode, I think the big moment and like turning point for me, I think in the first episode was really the food seemed evenly matched. Where they weren't evenly matched was their decision on how to serve the judges.
Yeah,
you mean one person's decision on how to serve the judges?
Yeah. And he was, and that was Jeremy, and he was the lead chef for that, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So he made that executive decision and was in a position of quote unquote power to do so.
Yeah. And I mean, that you're right. That is a kind of differentiator. I think that they were trying to say that both restaurants might have issues with service, but it's clear pretty much from the jump that Marjorie is plying the people away from the tables with alcohol.
That was clever.
She's doing smart things to get through their service. And Jeremy is saying, I don't care about our service. I just want to impress the judges. And that comes back to hurt them. Certainly, they have less prep
time.
Classic frat dad move. CC up rocks there. But yeah, this is something that you're right. There is the food seems about equal. There are good and bad kind of elements at each restaurant. The knock on palate seems to be that the food is not really adventurous, even if it's decent, and even if the entrees are very good. The starters at District LA are considered to be very good. Jeremy actually does make a good crispy egg and asparagus dish. Kwame makes a good corn velouté. So the whole drama over the bacon really is for nothing because the pancetta adds plenty to the dish and the judges do really like it. And Tom really does like the lunch menu overall at District LA. But the main issue does seem to be Jeremy's decision that does impact their service. And Kwame is sort of just kind of lost in the weeds on this because he has to suffer the consequences of this decision. And we don't see Kwame doing what Marjorie did, which is just really burning through people, getting them out as quickly as possible. So I do think we do leave this episode with not a lot of clarity, but the arrow is pointing down for District LA because of the choice that Jeremy made. The dishes that were the second Phillips dish, Amherst dish, they were okay. They didn't cause problems. The food wasn't bad. There weren't really complaints about that. On the flip side, Palette had good dishes and maybe not as adventurous. Like I said, their entrees were better. Their starters were okay. But, food wise, you're right, Kurt. We're about on the same level here in the service in terms of the lunch service. But the service itself is certainly a differentiator. Before we get through to kind of the end of this episode and the beginning of the second episode, does anybody have any other comments about the rest of this first episode? We did see some former chef testants popping up here.
Yeah,
like we got sighting.
Apparently Brooke from season 10 was there as well, but they both got Jacques LeMaid because we didn't get any sort of lower third about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hate, as if like Brooke hadn't gotten dissed enough. That's unfortunate. I love Brooke. Team Brooke. Love you, Chris and Kish, but I'm Team Brooke.
That's probably one of the strongest final twos ever, in my opinion. I think they were super solid. I would say, just to talk a little bit more before we jump to the end here, I mean, this is a moment when I'm like, wow, Philip is strangely right about this. And granted, Philip's about to completely undo himself over the next 42 minutes, but in the leaving this at the end of the first episode, and I even like tweeted it out that, I was greatly surprised at how correct Philip was. And then the edit seemed to be pointing towards like, well, maybe Philip's actually going to leave Restaurant Wars unscathed because he was vocalizing the clear logic of Jeremy's faulty logic, I should say, in Jeremy's decision, which is the judges are here for an entire restaurant experience. If they're getting preferential treatment, that's great. They'll get the food out. But Tom was very quick to notice, hey, we're eating right now, but only two other tables are actually eating food. And as a result, not only did Jeremy, kind of make that prevalent, he ended up screwing everything else because that meant 45 minutes where they couldn't work on dinner service. So they were, they were off to a bad start to begin with when dinner service hit. So Philip was a good, surprising source of reason here in terms of vocalizing to the audience exactly what went wrong with Jeremy's decision. And I was very surprised with that because outside of Philip's random win the previous week, we haven't seen too much logic come out of Philip's confessionals.
Yeah, that's a really good take, Josh. And I think that, one of the things...
Mike, you sound a little hoarse there.
Yeah, a little hoarse right now. I think that, when Philip is the guy who's making sense and he is the one who's making sense about your failings, you are probably screwing up really, really hard. So that's a real indictment of frat dad there.
Yeah, but what's shocking is it just doesn't come into play at all. Like it really, at the end of the day, spoiler alert, when we have the judges table at the end of this episode, they said, Jeremy, he's on balance. He's zero. He's netted out because he made good food. He made bad food. The risotto wasn't good, but the crispy egg was good. So he's netted out. They don't even take his service decision into the equation, it seems, at all, which is frustrating to me because
I agree.
Yeah, I really thought that Jeremy stood a solid chance to go home.
I thought it was going to be him, to be completely honest.
I mean, he
Yeah, I did too. And it was, I thought it was completely invalidated how they're at as soon as they get to judges table, they say like, well, Dern was tough because we got backed up during lunch because of a decision that Jeremy made. And Jeremy was totally ready to come there with his hat in his hands and say like, I screwed up. But Tom just immediately waves it away and says, oh, well, no, we don't care about dinner. We don't care about lunch. Dinner was the crux of our argument. And so, yeah, I feel like Jeremy actually did play a big part in dinner as well, because he kind of screwed up everything. They could have taken a few more minutes to try things and refine their dishes if they didn't waste all that time trying to catch up from Jeremy's mistakes during lunch.
Yeah, it's possible that the strawberry dish was just so bad and the service issues that Philip had were bad enough that it just obliterated any of the negativity with Jeremy. I'm surprised it came down to Philip and Amar, though, and not Philip and Jeremy, because the risotto was not good either. And Jeremy did make negative executive decisions at lunch. So he escapes here. We'll see where the arrow goes for Jeremy after this. But he definitely...
Another arrow reference. Yes,
indeed. I love it.
The other brief thing I want to say is that I know, Antonio, you said that Palette's starter dishes were okay, but Carl took a big hit for his tureen here.
I was worried.
And between that, and we talked about this offline, but in all the previews leading up to Restaurant Wars, we heard Carl's executive chef say, I'm sending raw fish out to the judges. For some reason, that didn't happen. I don't know whether that was ADR'd in or something happened to sort of rectify that, or was taken from another challenge. Who knows with these happy elves? But I think had Palette somehow lost, I feel like Carl would definitely be on the chopping block and actually might have gone, because of all the Palette dishes, his was by far considered the worst. Tom called it spam-like.
Cat food. I mean, it...
Well, spam is preferable to cat food, so at least he's not calling it cat food.
I am. I'm ready to call it that. Just...
And in Hawaii, they love the spam, and it's actually really good.
And here's Chef Sheldon saying, yes, spam is good.
Exactly. It's good. It's not bad if they do it right.
But yeah, I agree. I mean, Carl did, he did have of the team at Palette. He didn't have the best day. His snapper crudo was tasty. And at the end of the day, when we got the comments at judges table, there were only positive comments about it. But we also saw a kind of a long rant. We'll get into episode 2 Attack of the Clones here in just a moment. But we got a long rant from Tom about how it was derivative and repetitive to continue to make crudos, the new pork belly, he calls it. So while it was tasty, there were issues with that as well. So getting into episode 2, Tom and Chef Dean Strang come out here and they say, you know, push harder for dinner, stretch yourself, how to make a murderer, whatever, you know, making a murderer. I don't know what's happening here. This guy, do you know much about Bill Chait? Does anybody know much about Bill Chait? I just think he looks like Dean Strang. I really do.
He does. It's really uncanny. I said this to my wife while we were watching. It's like, hey, it's Dean. It's him. It's but him. Where's
I don't know much about. I don't know
that
much
that the internet's not as in love with.
Yeah, I don't know much about Jerry Buting. I don't know much about.
I love Jerry. I'm Team Jerry.
I don't know much about Bill Chait as a chef, but this is his big deal. I guess he's a big LA chef. We didn't have Philip, you know, coming in and saying, "Oh, Bill Chait, he's the biggest restaurateur in LA. I know him because he's eaten at my restaurant several times." So we didn't have the kind of narration from Philip telling us who this guy was. So I guess he's just an LA restaurateur who happens to look like Dean Strang. So good for him. They tell the chefs, you know, really stretch yourself, because the food was a little bit safe. I think this plays right into Palette's kind of plan, because that was already their plan, kind of step their menu up for dinner. So that's fine for them. See, they don't have to worry about that. It is a little bit of an issue, though, for District LA, because they are behind. They're so behind, in fact.
They're cooking breakfast now. They're so behind.
They're so behind. They're cooking breakfast. Not only are they cooking breakfast, Philip has to get some random guy named Damien to slice strawberries. Yeah. What the heck's going on here?
I've drafted Damien to my team, dibs.
Well, I'm going to draft Mike Isabella to my team then.
I mean, okay. Seriously, though, how are you allowed to bring in random guy Damien to do prep work for you?
I was actually wondering that myself. I was like, is this... And Philip, and I also noticed Philip is the only person who was actually making just a single dish. He was only working on the strawberry salad. Everybody else had two different dishes that they were working on. But Philip has his one strawberry salad, and he splits the work with Damien. I'm surprised he didn't throw Damien under the bus.
Yeah, well, the strawberries.
This is all.
There was this man by the name of Damien, and I believe he sliced my strawberries incorrectly. That allowed my soup to be thick. Yeah. And that's clearly the problem. Don't eliminate me.
Yeah, you see this salad? This is all for you, Damien.
Yeah, who is this guy, though? He's just standing around back there. Okay. Phillip's like, you wanted to help, right? Like, what are there? People just standing there like, I'm happy to do prep work. I'll be your sous chef if you want. Like, I've never seen this. It's crazy to me that Phillip just...
He's a cameraman.
Yeah, he just pulled somebody into Restaurant Wars, and all of a sudden they've got an extra team member doing prep. I mean, I don't know. I guess Damien couldn't have helped stuff the salmon on Team Palette. Is that not something he couldn't have put rice and salmon and folded it over? He couldn't have where do we stop with this? I was fascinated by this, that we just...
I'm surprised Phillip didn't walk into the dining room and pull somebody up. Like, I know you're waiting for your dinner right now, but if you could please just help me real quick. It's a really immersive experience we have here at District LA. You get to almost slice your own strawberries for your meal.
Katsuji in there. He would have absolutely added a whole lot of spice to Phillip's dish.
Spinning it as like at District LA, you can. There's actually a chef's table in the back. You just have to kind of help with some of the prep work, but you get to eat back there.
Basically,
that's part of the theme. That's good.
Yeah. Philip is kind of the Top Chef version of Kramer. I feel like this idea is very similar to the pizza place where you get to toss the dough and make your own pizza.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know. It's fascinating to me that this guy's just standing there. And was he there to be a server? And Philip drafted him in?
I think so.
I mean, he's wearing a different kind of clothing, so I wasn't 100% sure on that, exactly what's going on there. We can talk about the servers, too, on this episode, because that does come into play. The random day... day laborers that come in to serve at the restaurant, who presumably are professionals in the hospitality industry. There are some issues at District LA, especially with the server for the judges table. So we'll get into that. Maybe Damien was supposed to serve the judges table and somebody else got drafted into service there. But we've got a menu here at District LA where it's very complicated. There's several different items on this. A dinner menu is pretty complex. It starts off with what Amar calls an amuse-bouche. The amuse bouche that Amar is talking about Kwame making. We talked about the foam in play there. There is this debate again. The salad gate comes back up about the oil and lemon juice. Did you guys feel Philip is telling the servers, be proud, we're opening a restaurant, and the servers are kind of rolling their eyes at him. Do you feel like there was some revenge in play there, that they didn't do a good job because they hated Philip from the jump?
Oh my God, what a conspiracy that would be.
I mean, I'm surprised Philip didn't bring it up.
I wonder if the Bangkok nightmare, what was it called again?
Bangkok Dangerous.
I forget my own nickname,
yeah. I wonder if that tasted weak because all the servers were actually hitting it and then spiking it with just like water. So I'm basically wondering if all the servers were drunk off of Bangkok Dangerous and then watered down what was actually there for the guests.
That one guy was like, you guys need to get drunk like me. Here's all of the wine.
Yeah, get some more wine. Let me take your plates.
What up, Calicchio?
It's weird because we did not see Philip giving that guy specific instructions. Like, keep those judges drinking. Keep them happy. Get their food off the table as quickly as possible. Rotate them through the dishes. But that is what happened. Like, the chef is...
Fill their wine up to the top of the glass. Yeah,
so are you saying we have a rogue waiter, a guy who's like, well, I'm going to be on TV, so I'm going to fill up their wine to the brim.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
It's Restaurant Wars meets The Mole.
Yeah, exactly.
It's only in play. I mean, it's only interesting to me because the judges, Tom does mention it. He talks about the cocktail stand at the front of the house when he's judging. He talks about other things, but he does in the judges' table comments when they're talking about who to eliminate. He brings up the service at dinner and is really complaining about that server's lack of subtlety. And he's putting that on Philip. So I think that that's fascinating because this is just a random guy that's never going to work with Philip again, presumably, who Philip is in charge of, who the judges have issues with. But we never really see Philip telling the guy to do what the guy did. Now, we don't see Philip telling the guy not to do it. But this is a mark against Philip, and it's just a random rogue dude. So who knows?
Do we want to talk for a second about the way the judges interacted throughout these two episodes? Because maybe they were like punch drunk from having to also do lunch and dinner service in the same day, but they were very mouthy during dinner service in particular. I mean, they were cracking jokes. I mean, we'll talk about Gail's reaction to Philip's salad later on, but it seems like maybe they got a lot of the wine that Philip's waiter was pouring into their glasses and immediately poured down their throats because they just seemed overly verbose from what they usually are.
Yeah, I mean, four different services throughout the day. They certainly had some liquor in them and had drank some a little bit, and were a little punchy for sure. And then I just think, Josh, what do you think about this? Josh or Mike, you, whichever one of you wants to pretend to be the other. I'm just curious here. It feels like Tom kind of came into District LA for dinner with a little bit of a Phillips-sized chip on his shoulder, and that he was just not ready for any antics. And as soon as the antics started, and as soon as we got a foam right away, and as soon as we got a cocktail, a Bangkok Dangerous, and the magic trick, and all of it, Tom just is immediately starting to reject it. Gail, too. And punchy or not, they just did not seem to be having it at District LA at dinner.
But do you think that it's a Phillip-sized chip on his shoulder, or do you think that Philip is earning these, you know, these critiques? You know, is he earning the ire of the chefs? Like, you get Gail saying, Gail, who you could kind of probably level accusations at Tom of being like irascible and grumpy, and maybe he's the kind of guy who's out for vengeance sometimes, but not Gail. And Gail is the one who says, I'm actively angry at this dish. It's like, I'm mad at Phil's strawberry salad. So I feel like that's the barometer. Like, if Gail is the one who is angry at food, that's probably like, earned, you know, it's not some sort of premeditated thing. But yeah, I think that they were exhausted with Philip at this point in the competition. Can you blame them? And I think that, you know, all of Philip's weaknesses were spilling out here. And what are you going to do? Not, you know, critique it harshly. And I think that it was good television. They know that they're making a show.
Yeah. So, she kind of comes in angry, though, because she comes in and they're talking about the menu and they're kind of mocking the fact that I've got some Asian notes, I've got some Italian notes. But she says, I cannot see a single thread of consciousness in District LA's menu. Like, that's her critique from the jump. So that's before she's tasted any of the food, except for the Bangkok Dangerous.
Yeah, we say, well, I think it does start out with the Bangkok Dangerous, as what you want to joke about that is like.
Good thing we're not judging this restaurant on Bangkok Dangerous.
No!
That, I just have to say, I watched that like 10-second clip like 3 times. That made me just so, I laughed out loud. Not just that he kind of said it like with this grin on his face. Like I wondered if he was like trying to like plant the thought that he wouldn't be judging, or if he literally thought he wouldn't be. But then like the simultaneous reaction from all four judges, like, what do you mean you're not being judged on that?
It's just like,
I'm sorry.
It's just like the great thing that like the henchman in the movie says right before the Terminator shoots him in the head. Like, it's exactly. Like, oh, good thing I'm not being judged on the cocktail. Dead. Done. Yeah, finished. Immediately. Yeah, great final words.
But I'm wondering if did they give thought to the cohesion between the lunch and the dinner menus? Because it seemed, at least with Palette, it was maybe an evolution and like a step up of the game. But in terms of like literally, like you were saying, Antonio, it was the Bangkok Dangerous surprise followed immediately by like, you know, the salt foam. I mean, it was like, it was such a stretch from the unremarkable lunch, but it was like, you know, like 3 or 4 blunders in a row of just like miscalculated attempts at creating spectacle. I think it quickly became very apparent that District was screwed at dinner.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say that part of me actually, again, results oriented behavior here, but part of me kind of didn't want this season to be the coronation for the lunch and dinner service after what happened, because I would have liked it to be a more of a horse race, you know, and to have one team be utterly destroyed in theory kind of because of this concept. Because if it was just lunch, I think they could have done okay. Maybe Palette would have lost, but because they had to do two services, it became a clear blowout by the end. And I don't know, I would have rather liked to see two more, like maybe even, you know, last season's, even though one team was clearly outmatched. I feel like that was even more even than this time's was. I almost feel like this might be a big hyperbolic statement to make. I feel like District may have been one of the worst performing Restaurant Wars teams in Top Chef history.
I was wondering the same thing. I don't necessarily blame it on the two meal format. I, you know, again, like the one team had this deal with the same constraints. And I could definitely have seen Team Frap Bro having developed that exact same dinner plan, whether or not there had been a lunch menu. But I was wondering the same thing, Mike, like is this the least successful Restaurant Wars team in the history of Top Chef?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, and more kind of fascinating about that is that this dinner service that we're criticizing and that the judges criticized at District came on the heels of the judges having already had Palad's dinner service. So they went mm-hmm. to what was a very good dinner service with dishes that they, by and large, really did like. The consommé with the tripe and tortellini was well received. Isaac's braised dish was really well received. Marjorie's bread was really well received. Her panna cotta, not as much. Fizzy, they didn't outright hate it though, and they certainly didn't make faces like they made when they tried Chef Almer's barbecue sauce. So, and we'll get into that. But yeah, the dinner service for Palad seemed to go really well. Isaac pointed out that Carl was erratic as a caffeinated squirrel, but that in this case it worked. They seemed to use a very similar expediting system that they used successfully at lunch. All these things were really good at Palad. And so then when they get to District and you immediately get greeted with a magic trick, even if it is one involving free booze, where a guy's pulling, cocktails out of host stands, this is, you know, they're off on the wrong foot and they've already had kind of a high bar or high watermark to compare themselves to. So that's mm-hmm. not a good start for them. And I think that it really goes downhill from there. And, you know, there's not a lot of confidence in what District is doing. Kwame, in fact, changes his dish up for the judges to make it more one bite. And one of the immediate criticisms of the dish is there's not enough fish in it because he has changed the portion size. So there are these things that are, you know, they're doing 11th hour kind of changing to that aren't working. And then there are other things where they're not making any changes to, like the strawberry dish that they probably should. In the prep, Philip is kind of telling the servers to tell people how to eat the salad. And Amr's like, don't tell people how don't to eat, them. You know. But in that moment, Kwame is like, Philip, your dish is too sweet. Are you sure you don't want to salt these onions? Like, he's trying to give him feedback in that moment, and Philip's not hearing it. He says, everything's ready. Just put it on the plate. So this is this dish was sort of doomed from the beginning, and Kwame was trying to do what Kwame has done for so many other chefs throughout this competition and help Philip make adjustments to his dish so he didn't get sent home. If Philip had just listened to Kwame, does he go home?
I think it's debatable. I think it still might be closer with Amar, but I mean, I think Philip's dish was okay from lunch, from what I remember. I think it actually might have been their least favorite out of the four at District during lunch. But I think his front of house antics were probably might have been even more egregious than his strawberry stuff in terms of sending him home. I think had Philip, you know, not been Philip in the front, he might have served a better chance. And maybe Amar, surprisingly, again, over Jeremy, would have gone home. But I don't know. I think the strawberry salad was just the nail in the coffin, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that if he had tweaked it, you know, it'd be interesting to see if he would just get penalized on the front of house stuff. I think that the big regret that he should have, that we should have, that everybody should have, is that Philip himself was not the guy popping up from behind the podium with the Bangkok Dangerous.
Well, he already had his other shadow puppet moments when he was introducing his dish on the golf course underneath the sheet.
I know.
So clearly he has a niche.
It just it would have been so great for him to be the guy who emerged like, hello, Tom.
So we meet again.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like Philip got a little bit of a raw deal here. I know I seem like the outlier in this, but I felt like Jeremy's errors were more egregious, and I didn't actually feel like Amar did any better than Philip. But there are antics in the front of house. I think they're edited to look like even bigger antics, showing people his tattoos. Showing, you know, that he's talking about his other restaurants, and then having Tom say, I bet anything he's talking about his other restaurants. Certainly it's edited to look like serious antics, but I didn't get the impression that service went as poorly in the dinner as it did at lunch, which Philip wasn't in charge of the lunch service. So I don't know. I just feel like Philip's dish was the ultimate problem, but it felt like a little bit like they showed up just waiting to bash Philip. And I'm not the biggest fan of that. The dish, though, did seem to be a non-starter. And I don't want to make excuses for Philip, but it did sound like he compromised a dish that he normally would have served a little bit differently. But at the end of the day, he did approve it to go out how it was. So it is ultimately his fault that he goes home, because the dish is just hilariously bad. They talk about, Tom says without the onions, it's a dessert. Gail says she's angry. She says it feels stupid and has no purpose.
Yes.
Dean Strang's up there saying young chefs think they can just do anything. You can't just do anything. So this is not, it just is not well received at all. There's not a thread of good about it whatsoever.
Yeah,
I don't know. People laugh like about strawberry salads, but I feel like strawberries are a pretty good salad ingredient if you've got a good 100%. Vinaigrette.
Well, I think the problem is that it's sort of like when Isaac got the knock a few weeks ago about how he did like a salad and a soup in one dish. Philip basically did that, where it was like a strawberry salad gazpacho,
right?
And I think like it's just confusing. And as Gail says, it's just a stupid concept to say like, let me throw in a bunch of different ideas for appetizers into one dish,
right? Basically like strawberry sorbet that had melted down in a bowl that he garnished with onions. That sounds horrible.
I've had strawberry salads with onions and spinach and like pecans or walnuts and blue cheese. I mean, it's not so far removed from a salad, except the fact that it seemed it was just completely comprised of strawberries and onions.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I think was really bad about that is that the dish, the salad, had its own salad dressing, as we talked about a lot, with the olive oil and the lemon juice and the salt. That was the dressing for the salad. So what the heck is this strawberry nonsense around it? Like, the concept didn't seem to make a ton of sense, but maybe I don't know. Kurt, you're the biggest Cali guy out of all of us. Is it just that the emperors don't wear any clothes out there and no one ever says anything about it? Like, no one ever said to Philip, like, look, buddy, your dish has two different dressings. One of them is way too sweet and it's like a melted sorbet. Like, I know we're in California, so we have to act like everything's cool, but this is not cool, bro.
You know what? I bet he has been told. I wouldn't say that that's necessarily an LA thing. I think the bigger LA thing, it's not so much the not telling as it is to the complete obliviousness and lack of listening.
Yeah, and I think that you're right. I think that it's the lack of listening. And I don't know. Philip was at the kind of end of his rope here, and I feel a little bad for him, only because he is a bit of a goon, but he was having a rough time with Kwame and the rest of his team kind of executing what he wanted. And Restaurant Wars, this is what we wanted. This is why we wanted Philip in Restaurant Wars, not only for his front of house antics and the hilarious descriptions of his tattoos, but also because we knew he just wouldn't jibe with his team.
But did he have an issue with them executing on his vision? It sounds like they executed on his vision. They just had recommendations for his vision on how to make it better, and he was having none of it.
Right.
Plus, he wanted to be front of house before this whole twist of everyone has to be either executive chef or front of house. He'd agreed before that challenge even started, I want to be front of house. And he knows, Marjorie talked about the rules of Restaurant Wars earlier on in this episode. One of the rules is if you're front of house, you're going to have to live with the fact that these people working in the kitchen might, you know, they're going to try to put out your dish to the best of your ability. And so it's a big risk that Philip had to take. So I'm assuming he had to be at least content with the fact that, you know, I'm not personally making this dish, but it's my dish at the end of the day that I'm going to be judged on.
Was this the first, time in Restaurant Wars where we've seen them really position front of house as general manager? Because, I mean, they were talking a lot about I'm the general manager. So they kind of use the terms front of house and general manager interchangeably. Is that something that we've seen in previous seasons, or is that kind of the first time that that's really kind of been positioned like that here?
I mean, I feel like, I don't know if they've used the term general manager, but I feel like front of house has always represented that position, right?
Okay.
You determine the decor, you train the staff. I mean, that was Carrie Ann's big crux last season, was that she just was in over her head and she had a really big problem training the staff and figuring out the table numbers. So maybe they haven't outright said general manager, but I feel like that feeling has always been there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And I think that, you know, you guys have pointed out that Philip really did scale back. Karen was making 2.5 dishes and running front of house at Palette and needed a lot of help. help from other chefs to get her dishes together. But the help that she needed was like folding over the trout or just doing kind of basic prep work, not putting the whole dish together. And I think that in Philip's case, if the dish was very complicated, the reason I say that, you know, that it seemed like there was some problems with execution or there were some butting of heads is if you go back and listen to Philip's conceptualizing of the dish and the scene where the crux of the scene is them rejecting Philip's ideas as being too complicated. He's talking about noodles. He's talking about like a crumble. He's talking about a whole lot of things that didn't sound like they made it into the dish. So I don't know if he was talking about a different dish when he was talking about those things, or if it's this same salad dish, which has been pared down and refined in a way that just didn't work because it got stripped away to its core, which was just strawberries and melted sorbet with a couple of slices of onion. So it's not 100% clear, but I think that more than anything, and this is probably why Philip deserved to go home at the end of the day, is that if you do conceptualize a very complicated dish, you can't do that and still be front of house. You can't hand someone a dish to execute for you and say, I am sorry, it's got 15 steps and I know you have to do it 75 times, but you're going to have to do it. And
it's a bad idea.
You know, that's just a bad idea. You're dooming yourself from the start. If you're
you got to have something simple, you know, something that's just like easy to execute, something that's not a lot of steps, something that's straightforward that anybody can replicate. Yep. If you're going to be away from your dish. Yep.
And I think that that's the biggest mistake on Philip's part. And I think what it does come down to is kind of what we've talked about, which is that he took an existing dish that he knew he had some success with and that he enjoyed. He tried to shoehorn it onto a menu that didn't make sense from the standpoint of any kind of cohesiveness on the menu. And it also didn't make sense to take that complicated of a dish and expect somebody else to put it out for you. And I think that at the end of the day, that is why Philip really gets himself into hot water. We didn't really talk about the rest of these things. Almar makes what Tom refers to as crab nachos. And you know, it just tasted like guacamole and nachos and had tortillas in it. This is the dish that didn't sound like they didn't like it, but they maybe didn't like the concept of it. We talked about Jeremy's risotto, not cooked in broth, not cooked very well. Two big knocks on Jeremy's risotto for sure. We haven't really.
They say it's one of the very worst risotto's they've ever had.
Yeah, which I mean,
which is saying something.
Trey and All Stars, I think, went home for his risotto at Real's in New York. So other people have gone home for bad risotto before. Jeremy somehow manages to escape here, even though it's one of the worst. So that's interesting. Kwame makes a boring chicken, one note, bland. It's not been a good run of episodes for Kwame. Do you guys think that there's any hope for Kwame to kind of get his mojo back?
It's been really, really bad for Kwame. And my biggest surprise of the episode wasn't, Philip going home or anything. That seemed like that was clearly the direction we were going in. I was surprised that the conversation wasn't about Philip and Kwame. I thought that Kwame had done really poorly in this episode and has been doing bad. Like, he can't get out of the past. Like, the moment that he went back to the past and had his, like, depressing, you know, post-trauma situation, he just hasn't been able to get out of that funk. And it sucks. So what are you going to do? But Kwame's, like, really bad right now.
I'll counter things with a couple points. And again, maybe it's because Kwame is on my team. But I will say that before these episodes, I think I put Kwame above Isaac in my enjoyment of Chef Testin's list. But Kwame's fallen down because he's a little bit of a Debbie Downer, specifically these past few episodes. And maybe that's just his personality. But I'm starting to have more fun with Isaac than Kwame at this point. Yeah. I mean, yes, Kwame has, like you said, Josh, I think since he had to go back to the past, I think he's put himself in a funk. That being said, I mean, judges said his velouté and his not only his lunchtime meal, but they really liked him at front of house. I personally don't see it. They said he was very like genuine and cordial. I don't know if that really comes off on camera than it does in person, but I think that was enough to sort of counteract what they didn't like with Amar and Philip. But at the same time, again, I'm gonna make this comparison. Let's remember Gregory from last season. Big front runner for the first five or so episodes. Hit a huge bad streak in the middle of it, including Restaurant Wars, comes back and comes in second place. So I'm gonna try to say let's not count out Kwame yet. It might be because of the two people left in the game on my team. He by far has a chance of making the finals over Amar at this point. But I think he still has a chance of being able to salvage his game and make it to the end, especially because, you know, if Restaurant Wars really shook him up, you know, him realizing that there's a lot more to making a restaurant than he realizes. Now he'll be able to, almost like in the inverse of Isaac, he's able to just focus on himself and the food that he himself has to make instead of worrying about everybody else like he tends to do as Kwame for president. Maybe this will let him sort of make a renaissance in his cooking and realize like, okay, let me just stick with cooking good food, and his game will benefit from that.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think you're right. The Gregory kind of upside is what you're looking for. Gregory was able to pull himself out of this sort of funk that he got into. Kwame has not been able to, and he's not been cooking good food. And I don't know if it's, I don't know where his head's at, but he's really starting to struggle. And he was so ahead of it for a really long time. That's something that I definitely want to monitor kind of going forward is what's the upside for Kwame? Because right now, you guys can disagree if you want. It's looking to me like basically like a 3, maybe a 4 chef competition, or maybe just a 2 chef competition to see who wins. Josh, I know you and I texted about this. You think Marjorie and Karen are definitely front runners.
I think that Marjorie is the clear front runner, right? And like she's talked about as the Top Chef MVP directly in this episode. I feel like it would be, I feel like it'd be a real upset if Marjorie went home anytime soon. And I could really see her winning. She's so talented. She's, you know, everything that she makes is great. She was very fun in front of house. Like there's nothing that she does that isn't just like fully committed on her end. And she's just so focused and just has raw talent that I think it's going to be really difficult to derail that train. She doesn't seem like the kind of person that you can derail. So I think that Marjorie for me is the front runner. And I don't know. There's just something about Karen. I think Karen's got some confidence and she's got some skill. And yeah, her fish dish wasn't great, but her steak salad was really nice. I feel like Karen has had a few really good weeks here too. And there's just something that seems to me like we're moving in the direction of either Karen or Marjorie, if not taking home the whole thing, getting very, very close. Those are the two that I have my eye on. And I think before this week, I would have certainly said Jeremy seems like, you know, he's just like that type of guy who wins Top Chef. But A, I'm not so sure after this performance this past week, and B, really don't want to see that happen because I think just, man, the douche shows. Seriously.
Yeah. And what I will say is, I'm hesitant to count Kwame out at this point because, like Kurt said, you know, at the very beginning, talking about Phillip's win and subsequent elimination, this is a game where, especially when it gets down to where it's 7 chefs left, there's no real place to hide. You can make a bad dish and be sent home, even if you were one of the front runners, especially with Last Chance Kitchen in the picture, that chance for a fan favorite to come back. So, even though, like, yes, I think I could totally see Karen and Marjorie final, especially since they keep hyping up, oh, all the girls are eliminated except us. I think it'd be a great storytelling if the only 2 girls to survives like what, like 8 or 9 rounds to make it to the end. But there's always surprises that can happen. But the two that I can definitely count out, I think, are Amar and Carl. I mean, I think just looking at the numbers here, I don't believe any winner of Top Chef has not won a challenge before, like they've won challenges in like the first like 8 or 9 episodes. We're past episode 10 right now. We're in the latter third of the season. Amar and Carl have not won anything. They've done like pretty solid work overall, but I think the numbers don't lie in this, and I think that they could make it to like final 4 or 5, but I don't think they're making it to the finals at this point.
Yeah. Kurt, you want to say a word for Chef Carl?
Don't count him out, Mike Bloom.
That's it.
Well, that's it.
Was that Mike who gave you so much crap about Chef Carl the other week?
Well, not so much Chef Carl as much as my trend in the people that I root for in the shows.
Yeah,
that was Josh Wiggler.
That was really, really mean of Mike. Mike Wick really went full Bloom in that moment.
But in defense of Jeremy, as much as I was also starting to get like the douche chill meter was going, you know, up and up and up. He is very quick to, or very willing to admit when he's wrong. Like you said, he went to judge's table fully admitting that he had made mistakes. So which I think counteracts the douche chills that I do get from him. But I mean, one thing we haven't really talked about, and I think just the simplicity of it, and in support of Marjorie's bread.
Like, yeah. Like, secret weapon.
Yeah. And it wasn't even something, I think it was a nice surprise and delight because it wasn't, I think, something that was really even like listed on the menu. It was just something that kind of came out with when they sat down. It was like the bank. Why can I not remember my nickname, Antonio?
Bangkok Dangerous.
Dangerous. Gosh, why do I keep thinking Bangkok Nightmare? It was like the Marjorie's bread was the Bangkok Dangerous of palate.
Right.
Except, yeah. Well, I believe Gail called it savory monkey bread, which ironically enough was my nickname in college. So I very much resonated with that.
Nice.
That's great. That's a really good way of putting it, Kurt, is that was the Bangkok Dangerous of palate, which is like, this is the good idea. Like, this is the good treat.
Yeah. What's the surprise and delight that you can fit into Restaurant Wars, but skewing towards savory monkey bread instead of Bangkok Dangerous?
Yeah, exactly. That's great.
Yeah, and this is Marjorie's really sharp like that. She's really pretty smart. Isaac at one point says, Marjorie, I'm so glad you're making bread. I can't tell you how glad I am. And I think it's in part because it is a nice little surprise. It does work really well. It's just a really perfect little thing for them to do. It's not quite an amuse bush, but it's not bad. And it's savory monkey bread. So it's hitting on a lot of good things. You know, we also didn't really talk about just how awful of the sauce for Amar's the pork belly is. But I mean, apparently it's good with the pork belly, but on its own, it's woof.
Yeah, that was a great reaction on Gail just being like, no.
but I love that the perfect capper on that scene is Tom being like, well, pork belly is not bad.
Right.
You see like them like making these lemon faces almost, and absolutely, I think this is one of the first times this season where we've seen them make like vehemently disgusted faces on camera that really show. And then to have Tom cap it up by being like, well, the protein's not bad at all.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think it was a perfect sort of ending note on that
scene.
What
a bad night for those guys, though, because like that dish came out and I was looking at it, you know, they do like the shot of the food and everything before everyone starts eating it when they're describing it. And I was like, oh, that actually looks really good. Finally, District LA is turning out a delicious looking meal. And then that's the one where they're all just like, ugh! So it's just a really rough night for District LA.
And Amar has remarked like in previous episodes that he said he loves yellow mustard. He made the sweet and sour dish earlier. He really likes the sort of tangy, zingy flavors. It's something that he personally likes. I will tell you, as a barbecue connoisseur, vinegar-based barbecue sauce is not it's not an uncommon thing at all. Have to eat it with the pork, though. Otherwise, if you're eating it on its own, you're going to make that face. It's not surprising that happened.
I had some in South Carolina.
Yeah, Carolina barbecue. That's exactly where we're headed.
Had some at the Super Bowl party I was at last.
There you go. So this is,
and I had some crying alone in my apartment the other day.
just a spoon in a jar.
Yes. Yeah.
Listen, I was like, I need something vinegary to complement my vinegary emotional attitude right now. So it was a perfect compliment.
There was crying and rocking, right?
Absolutely.
What was that about, Mike? You were a big Denver Broncos fan, big Carolina Panthers fan. What's going on there?
This before the Super Bowl?
I was traumatized by Pumpy Monkey Baby. Okay. So I just wanted to get that image out of my head.
It might have been a Grease Live reaction. I wasn't sure. But yeah.
Oh, no.
This is something we have to talk about, Mike, because these incidents of you crying alone in your apartment, they need to be a little more few and far between.
You
guys are wrong. I'm totally fine. These are the best emotional reactions you could have had.
Yeah.
And you know what? These are the best emotional reactions I could have to getting trashed on Twitter by all the chef testants accusing me of calling them douchebags.
Mike, do you have a tattoo that says, "Mother, say you'll pray for me"?
No, I have a tattoo of a Hoobastank lyric instead, which I feel like has the exact amount of douchiness as Phillips does.
What is with those tattoos? What was the other one? Wolf am I?
Yeah,
I think they're both lyrics. I think "Mother Say You'll Pray for Me" is an AFI lyric, and I think I can't remember what "Wolf Am I" is, but that's another song lyric as well.
It's not like TV on the radio. That's like "Wolf Like Me." So who knows? But yeah, this is classic Philip, and he's showing his tattoos off to diners. I mean, what
is the fact that I like Hoobastank at all indicative and coincidental with my choice in Chef Testament's report?
Yes, Carl's favorite band is Hoobastank. Him and Brian Voltaggio are in a Hoobastank cover band.
I know I've given this article unnecessary amounts of plugs during this podcast, but on that UpRocks article by Vince Mancini, his picture of Carl is just a picture of Carl with his face, a white question mark.
Yes, I got to say, I've looked this up now, Antonio, because you have mentioned this article a bunch. It's very funny.
Yeah,
it's very funny. The nicknames for these people are great. Marjorie is Mike Mizabella Shior.
Shior is amazing.
Yeah.
Carl's is Charlie White guy, and him with a question mark. Oh, what's his face?
Oh,
what's his face is one of Carl's. That's really great.
I think, though, in terms of who's Kurt rooting for? I think every season I root for Charlie White Guy. I think that yeah. tends to, that is definitely the trend.
Can
that
be the name of your what's his face?
Can that be the name of your team next season? Which yeah. P.S. by the way, not announced on this podcast yet, but in the weeks where we were off, Top Chef officially renewed for season 14, yeah. gentlemen. Clark Curse is officially defeated
yeah.
now.
Yeah, we're back.
Where do you guys think
it's focused elsewhere? It's focused elsewhere.
Where do you think we should go for season 14? What U.S. city should we go to?
I'm pitching Atlanta again just so we can get those Goo Goo Blasters going.
Oh, gotta get those Goo Goo Blasters going.
I'm hoping for Top Chef Midwest, where they travel from like Milwaukee to Chicago to St. Louis,
Indianapolis, to Kansas City, Cincinnati.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The Top Chef flyover.
Top Chef flyover country. Chefs, we're on our way to Milwaukee. Oh, okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, beer
okay,
brats right. around, all around. This is going to be great.
Then Dean Strang can make an actual appearance on this show. Exactly.
Good point. Good point. And maybe they could actually go try to win a blue ribbon at the county fair with a ribeye. These things are all possible if you do the flyover, Top Chef flyover. That would be great. Yeah, this is a great development for Top Chef. Renewal for season 14. They don't go out on where they started in a California season. Hopefully, I mean, I can see Nashville happening. There's been a lot of discussions about that. We talked about this all last year on this podcast, where they should go. Atlanta, as Mike remarked, is something that we've talked about being in contention. So we'll just have to see the Top Chef season shooting kind of thing that happens. They look for the biggest tax breaks that they can get. They look yeah. for basically a net zero kind of cost on the production. So some city's going to have to bend over backwards to get Top Chef there. I'd love to see Cincinnati do it. That'd be awesome.
If it wasn't for that, I would really be pulling for like a Top Chef Europe or a Top Chef International, where it's a little bit more of a tour of cities.
Yeah.
I think you could really expand, like imagine like if they have 2 weeks in Rome and then 2 weeks in Paris and then two episodes in like Berlin or what have you. I think that could be a really interesting way to take it. But yeah, if taking cost into consideration, I just don't see it necessarily happening.
Well, they had that. There was a show on Bravo called Around the World in 80 Plates. I don't know if you guys remember that, but it was basically a combination of Top Chef and Amazing Race, where every episode they went to a different city or a different country and they had to basically run a bunch of different tasks to cook food in the style of that country.
Hmm. So I did throw the new show Tour Group into my DVR. So I'm looking forward to that on Bravo.
What would Last Chance Kitchen look like in that scenario? They're just, you know, if you don't cook well, you end up in like Ukraine or somewhere like that.
Well, basically what it would be is it's a giant cargo plane flying overhead. And basically if you lose Top Chef Kitchen, you get dropped out.
Oh God. Do you get a parachute at least?
Depends on if production likes you or not.
Okay.
So the question I guess is then anything else about the second episode?
I mean, I feel like we should talk. We didn't talk too much about Palette in the second half of the episode, but I just want to throw out the what if there. If Palette somehow loses this, I don't know, maybe like a meteorite comes and destroys the oven or something, so District somehow wins. Who goes home, Karen or Carl?
Carl.
You think so?
I think the only real disaster between the two services, it seemed, was the tureen from the first service.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Karen's trout dish, there wasn't a lot of good remarks about it, but I think her steak salad dish was probably better than Carl and Karen both worked on the consommé, so I think they're both going to get credit for that. And they actually
raved about her front of house service.
Yeah, and they really did like. But there wasn't a knock on his exec service either, though. So right. I think the dinner went very smoothly, and they didn't seem to have any issues. And Carl, being a good guy, I mean, I don't think Carl's a bad guy at all, even if he is bland. Like he really does credit Marjorie and Isaac, saying like they developed a good system at lunch. We just piggybacked on it. So that's why the service at dinner went well. And so there's a reason Palette won. It's because there weren't really too many issues. If District LA had knocked it out of the park and everything they conceived had been a home run, it is probably Carl going home for the tureen. I think that's probably right. You can't serve cat food like that.
You really raise a good point there. Is I think one of the key things here, and this is due to the interesting structure of a lunch service and a dinner service, is that Palette was able to capitalize on their successes from lunch to make dinner better, whereas District LA had to spend their time making up for their lunch mistakes. And I think that might have been the key reason why Palette won over District. One was able to be opportunistic and move forward from what they learned. The other had just so busily overcorrect on just what went wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it for sure. Anything else about the second episode of Restaurant Wars before we touch a little bit on Last Chance Kitchen?
Not for me.
All right.
No.
Hearing nothing, we'll go into Last Chance Kitchen. And Mike, do you want to set this up? This is a pretty hilarious kind of challenge we get here out of Tom.
I love this. So we've raved before about how we enjoy the Top Chef Last Chance Kitchen challenges because they've essentially in the past two seasons kind of skewed them in the way of you went home for insert reason here. We're going to take insert reason here and make it be the impetus behind the challenge that you're about to do in Last Chance Kitchen. And, you know, it's interesting with Philip because as Tom points out, Philip has a problem with blame. Philip has never blamed himself for any dish that he's made. Even on his walk out in the main show, he says he never cooked a dish wrong. It's just a matter of opinion, basically. So Tom basically says, okay, Philip, here's your challenge. You pick the time. You pick the ingredient we both have to use. And we'll have you put your money where your mouth is. And so I felt like at that moment, it could only end with Philip losing. That being said, it was still an enjoyable 13 minutes to watch.
Yeah, it's funny because the whole setup is no excuses. You're not going to be able to make any excuses. We're letting you pick the protein. We're letting you pick the time. And literally 2 minutes into prep, Philip cuts his finger and immediately has an excuse.
Yeah. No, well, it's not only that, but he also has an excuse of somehow blaming other people for sabotage. Maybe it was Damien who came back to get revenge on him. But
it would have been awesome if he pulled out Damien.
Yeah, because somebody apparently took his glove box and somebody like turned the blender on, I guess, while I wasn't looking. But that's why you got to love the peanut gallery here, especially the peanut gallery comprised of those characters that left us in the early rounds, because Philip basically is like, you know, bemusing like, oh, God, who did this? And everyone's just saying like, Philip, stop blaming people again. Wesley in particular, I feel like, has really taken on a role as like the head of the peanut gallery.
Yeah. He's just going nuts over there.
I like that Jason then immediately cuts his finger to even the playing field.
Yeah, it was a weird. They pick sweetbreads. Philip picks sweetbreads, to be more fair. And he picks 20 minutes for the prep. Sweetbreads are a difficult ingredient to work with. Is anybody in this foursome like sweetbreads?
I've never really had them, I don't think.
I don't eat too many calf brains in my lifetime. But that description alone does not make it sound that appetizing.
I've had it once. I think I was at like one of the restaurant in Vegas where I had it. It was pretty good, but it was the sort of thing I think somebody else had ordered it and I was trying it, like it was like a dish to pass. And I don't think I would ever order it myself, but if somebody was offering me some, I'd try it.
Worse than brains, Mike. It's like a thyroid. It's like an organ meat from the neck. And what's interesting about this is I didn't know what it was when I was like maybe 16 or 17. And locally in Cincinnati, there's a culinary school and they have like, you can come to their graduation. They have a restaurant there. And so we went to the restaurant, sweetbreads. I like bread. I like, you know, this sounds good. I like sweet things. And I ordered
it. I like sweet stuff.
It was, yeah. And like boy, I was very distraught.
Rude awakening.
You know, I think that it can be called, it can be cooked. I think the point they make on the Last Chance Kitchen is that it's a difficult ingredient. Doesn't mean it's a bad ingredient, but it can be very grainy. It can be very kind of muscly and difficult. I mean, you're talking about eating organ meat at the end of the day. It's not very different from tripe, which I have had a lot of in Vietnamese food, actually. You really have to cut it thin, cut it small, and really have to work with the ingredient to make it palatable. But once you do, it's fine. And I think that this is an interesting call. It doesn't really hurt either of the chefs that they cook it. Neither of them seems to do really well with the thing. We do have Jason winning, and so no more Philip, which is unfortunate, but he will be in the peanut gallery. But Jason doesn't – he's not really blowing me away in Last Chance Kitchen. It doesn't feel like he's dominating the competition. It just feels like the last couple of times he's won, the person that he's competed against hasn't done that well.
He's a placeholder. He's there until, you know, one of the people who's currently on the show will get knocked off and then knock him off and they will come back to the competition. He's not coming back.
If Carl faces Jason, is that Charlie White Guy versus Charlie White Guy?
No, Jason dresses like the Pacific Northwest. Remember, he has a little bit of flair right. To at least. I don't know what the Uproxx nickname for him is, but yeah, I mean, I think we've even said like the past couple of weeks, like, okay, Jason's going to lose the next one, right? He's going to lose the next one. And I think I said before that Phil might be the only person left in the competition that he could feasibly beat. I think, you know, if they catch one of these front runners on a bad day and eliminate them, I feel like they're going to mop the floor with Jason.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's probably probably true. I don't know if Carl beats Jason. Maybe he does. Does Amar beat Jason? I'm not sure. Does Kwame beat Jason? Maybe. I think we've seen something from each of those chefs to indicate that they probably could. But we've also seen each of those chefs being kind of a rough patch. Or Carl's never been on the bottom. So, and we've had that pointed out to us on Twitter. And that's I think that that's interesting. I think that that is something that we have to note, is that Carl has never really screwed up. But I do think that that there's nowhere to hide anymore. Like, now that we're through Restaurant Wars, now that a lot of the traditional targets are kind of gone, this is sort of a difficult time. And like we were talking about earlier, Josh, I'm not sure that the arrow is pointing all the way up for Isaac, even though I love him, even though his celebration was one of my favorite Top Chef moments ever. I could easily see Isaac going home next week.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally. I mean, just because he had an amazing Restaurant Wars doesn't mean it's going to all go well for him. But I think that, you know, if we've been waiting for a good sign for Isaac to be somebody to take seriously in this competition, we certainly got plenty of that this week. So reason to be optimistic, but I would say cautious optimism.
I think I'm more bullish on Jason than you guys are. I could see him coming back into the competition. I think in a situation where I think in the main competition where Jason was also having to kind of deal socially with these people, he was really out of his element. But something where he can just compete in the kitchen one-on-one. It's not about really the social relationships and having to live with these people in day in and day out necessarily. I think he's it feels like he's changed from the main competition to Last Chance Kitchen. I could actually, with the right series of challenges, see him coming back into the competition.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that, but I also could see someone like Isaac coming out and getting into a challenge where he's allowed to do something with some latitude about what he wants to do and just knocking it out of the park. Yeah. Like, I can see all it's going to take is one good dish to put Jason down. Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't mean the person that beats Jason's getting back in the competition, but the person that competes against Jason with the right challenge, they might be able to pull a dish out that just puts him away.
It's very rare that I feel like someone who gets eliminated in those early rounds makes it all the way to the end. I mean, Doug won last season and he had to win what, like two challenges, I think, because he got eliminated in fifth last time. So I feel like it's going to come down to someone gets unluckily eliminated in sixth or fifth place. They only need to win a few challenges, cook a few good dishes, and then they're going to find themselves back in the competition again.
I think the fact that people come into Last Chance Kitchen and have to face something that was their downfall in the main show, Jason just has to win four more challenges, and I could easily see him beating Kwame, Isaac, Amar, and even Carl. I completely think there's a chance.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think when you name those four names, I think he could, on a good day, beat those four, especially if what happens in Last Chance Kitchen ends up being something like, oh, Isaac, you went home for an Asian dish. Now you have to cook your best Asian dish. Like, I can see that saying, oh, sorry, Isaac. Like, Jason's going to beat you at that challenge. So depends on the challenge and the constraints therein, but he has a shot. But we'll track that going forward. It is interesting. We've got some long streaks in Top Chef history. Of course, CJ really is kind of the high water mark. But Kristen got eliminated at Restaurant Wars and did cook her way back into the competition through Last Chance Kitchen. So we've seen a streak at least this long with the chef going on to win the show. So we'll see what happens with Jason. He hasn't beaten anybody in these early ones where I'm like, oh my gosh, like Jason was so lucky to win that one. Chad seemed to do really well. And Philip is okay, but Jason hasn't knocked me down yet. So we'll see where this goes.
I don't know if I want to call Philip okay, considering that he basically produced like sweet potato puke on a plate in front of Tom and tried to pass it off as a choice.
We didn't talk about this, but Tom's don't bullshit a bullshitter line was hilarious.
Yes.
Tom just wasn't having it. I just think Tom was over Philip by the time that Philip ended up getting eliminated. And when Tom's over you, you're not making it farther on this show.
I mean, I'll be completely honest. I couldn't tell you much about what happened in Last Chance Kitchen other than Jason went. I kind of yah-yahed it through the entire thing in terms of I just figured. And this is basically more Philip kind of messing up, making excuses, and Jason winning. And that's exactly how it played out.
Yeah. All right. Anything else from these episodes? I know, Mike, you said there's a tease for the rest of the season.
Yeah, before we get into the tease, though, I do have one question here to sort of, I guess, bookend Josh starting this podcast by eulogizing Philip. It's been really interesting to me to track our responses to Philip versus our listeners' responses to Philip. I mean, I don't want to speak for all of us, but I think we've all been like, amused with Philip. We've all been amused bushes with Philip. I don't think that any of us are outright hating him, but it's been so interesting reading our comments week after week, which you can do on robhasawebsite.com, by the way, because, you know, we've gotten comments every week that, like, Philip's such an asshole. We got that question a couple weeks ago of, like, does Philip have the most punchable face in reality TV? And I'm not sure, guys. I'm trying to figure out what people see in Philip that provides such a vehement reaction, because, again, I don't want to keep making the comparisons to Coach from Survivor, but I feel like after watching Coach do his thing for three seasons, I'm okay with delusional people on reality TV nowadays. And I feel like the editors never wanted to edit him as an outright villain, just as a doofus. And so I had no problem with him overall in his time on the show. Yeah.
I just think when we have like 90 minutes to talk about a contestant, we can be a bit more nuanced. Whereas if you have 140 characters, or you're typing a sentence in a few comments, you have to be a lot more kind of polarizing in terms of it. I just think that's an artifact of how people are expressing themselves on the internet. If you got those same people onto a podcast to discuss them, I'm guessing the attitude towards Philip would actually be a lot more light than they're getting to express in social media.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Philip, I mean, there's definite backlash there. You have to go back to Emeril at the beginning of the season, making fun of his puffed amaranth and basically saying, like, this is new California cuisine. Like, that guy with the man bun and the puffed amaranth, like, that's what he is. And, you know, Marjorie was making fun of him even in that first episode for picking grass up where there's dogs. and this has been Philip from the jump. He's been sort of out of touch, in the bubble, like in his own world about what food should be and about where his food plays a role in that. But that's not to say that where he cooks and who he cooks for in California, he's not well received. And it's not to say that his food is like subjectively or objectively bad. I think people do like it in California. And I think that he's got a lot of drive and he's got a lot of passion about what he does. And he's got a lot of passion about himself. And Tom on these episodes remarked that all chefs have ego and all chefs have attitude. And if we don't have that, we say we're lying. Because we have those things, that's why we're chefs. And so I think to ding Philip for a lot of what all the people have and just not being calibrated correctly on it is a little bit unfair, because I'm not of the world that Philip rolls in. So I don't know if he stands out in that world or not. You know, they were making fun of him for having his picture on the front of his restaurant when they drove by it, the other chefs. And, you know, that in California seemed like it was like pretty commonplace, or especially in LA where he was, like, this was not a surprising thing. So who
knows? I've never seen that before.
Even in LA, even in Hollywood, that's a no-go.
I was more like South Bay area and like the Venice side, which I thought was where, I can't remember where exactly his restaurant was. I know he was familiar with Venice. I couldn't remember if his restaurant was in Venice, but in terms of like, I ate quite a bit in LA and I do not remember seeing like, you know, dust jacket cover photos associate like, you know, larger in life in the front of the restaurant.
Well, this is the last we'll see of Philip besides the peanut gallery moments on The Last Chance Kitchen. So we'll have to pour one out.
Unless he's brought back as a helper chef.
Oh, God, please. Oh, yes.
Please. Man upstairs, we're asking you for one more favor this season. You got Philip to Restaurant Wars. We're very grateful for that. Please let him be brought back. Please let someone make a terrible misjudgment in the finals and bring Philip back as someone, as a sous chef, because it's just going to be television magic once again.
Who would balance that out?
I mean, no one. There's no one. There's no one who could balance it out.
I feel like Marjorie would put him in his place.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way that happens is if, when Stephen Kay said, send a prayer to St. Emeril that Philip gets picked as helper in the finale on our Twitter. But I would say,
and it would have to be like a randomized
thing. It would have to be. There's no
Francis?
Other way this happens.
Like Frances, maybe? Would she?
Well, I think it's All Stars, right? Where they have a blind cook-off, where the eliminated chefs come in and they cook one dish, and then the chefs taste the dish and they pick who they want to be their helpers based on the best dishes that they eat.
Right, that's right.
And so I don't know that Philip would get back in that way. I don't know that. I think immediately a chef would probably be able to identify Philip's food.
Because it's served on a rock.
Yes, and it's covered in strawberry ice cream.
It's the exact same strawberry salad.
But there's always the possibility that that could be the reality, that there could be some sort of blind cook-off and you could end up, you can do that in an All-Star season because theoretically, no matter who you end up with, is going to be a good chef. I'm not sure you can do that in a plain season of Top Chef, where you might end up with somebody who's just totally, it might be a really unfair disadvantage and you don't really want to subject the final to that sort of gamesmanship or the bad decision. So I don't know what we'll see out of that. It would be fun to see Philip in some other capacity in that way. But look, if you're jonesing for Philip, you can watch Guy's Grocery Games. You can watch
Charles Grocery Games. He almost won Guy's Grocery Games Tournament of Champions, which is probably the closest he'll ever get to winning any sort of competition in his life.
I thought he won Cutthroat Kitchen.
I thought he won Chopped.
Did he win Cutthroat?
So, I can see him coming back as one of the sabotages that you buy to inflict on one of the other players in Cutthroat Kitchen.
He might do well on Foolish Cooks in America.
Yeah, Foolish Cooks.
Yeah, he might do well on that show.
But you have to do it ironically, like when they had that pop star show on WB where it was actually the worst singers, but they thought they were the best, to be like, Philip, you're going to be on a show called The Best Cooks in America. Here, what will help you, though, Anne Burrell will help you with your cooking, even though you're one of the best chefs. Don't worry about it. The cameras are just there for no reason.
Anne Burrell and Philip on the same show just sounds like the worst time on television ever. Just sounds like the worst.
Well, and we'll link this in the website or in the comments here. Rob has a website. Philip did an interview with a website called SheKnows.com, where he describes how he feels about his elimination, what he feels was unfair about the judging. I haven't read it, but what's really funny is there's four comments on the article. Two of them use the word delusional. So it'll be a funny read for those who haven't read the article, including myself. I read just the first maybe two questions in it. And I thought, oh my gosh, we have to link this because Philip is being Philip in this for sure. So he says his favorite Top Chef contestant of all time was Stefan. So there you go. Situate that there. We'll link that. We'll link as well to the UpRocks article that we've talked about a lot. Anything else from these episodes, guys?
I'm good.
All right.
We saw a weird, here's what the next six episodes are on Top Chef, but we don't really need to talk about it since we're going to be seeing it over the next 6 weeks. Parrot what Josh said earlier of we're at a very weird place in the season now, because I feel like a lot of the front runners kind of, with the exception of maybe Marjorie, kind of did get knocked down a couple pegs the past few weeks, which makes things exciting. It's going to be a very open competition, but at the same time, I feel like there's an inherent sense of danger now where nobody is really safe. And even though I would say that the Wig Zorro team is probably looking the strongest right now coming out of Restaurant Wars, for all we know, it could be a Jeremy Marjorie, I'm thinking blanking on your third person now. It could be a 1-2-3. Oh, Isaac, sorry. Jeremy Marjorie Isaac 1-2-3 out the door for the next 3 weeks. Could be that crazy of a season.
It's been up in the air all season long. That's been one of the reasons why it's been entertaining. But what had been interesting is I felt like it had been up in the air because everyone was doing so well and there was so many potential contenders. And right now, I think a lot of people, as you said, Mike, got knocked down, and let's see if they can
get back up again.
Let's see if they can do some tough thumping here. Yeah,
that's the tattoo that I really have.
Yeah, you got a Chumbawamba tattoo. Yeah.
He gets knocked down, but he gets up again. It makes perfect sense. Yeah,
he drinks a whiskey drink. He drinks a vodka drink.
Yes,
he drinks a Bangkok Dangerous.
he throws up.
That's true. It's true. We're going to see David Copperfield, by the way, on one of these next six episodes of Top Chef. So
Threw the remote through the television when she saw that.
The last time we saw David Copperfield on TV was the Amazing Race 24 finale, which is probably the worst hours of television I've seen in quite a long time. So that does not bode well.
That's really funny. Well, so we'll see. I mean, it looked like they were using smoke and making magical effects with food. So we'll have to see how that plays out. I don't know if that's the next episode. They gave us the rest of the season tease, so we don't know what's coming up next week, but we'll be here next week to talk about this. You guys have a hashtag for this episode for people that want to tweet at us?
I've got six.
All right, let's hear them. Kurt.
List them off.
Okay. Dr. Evil Philip.
Okay. All right.
Frat Dad. Amused Bush. Charlie White Guy. Shior. And Top Chef Flyover.
I like Top Chef Flyover or Amused Bush.
I like Top Chef Flyover.
Top Chef Flyover is good. I'm worried about that other one. Yeah. I'm worried about that other one.
Yeah, well, it's already taken.
I'm worried that might be already taken. So if you liked what we were doing here, or if you just want to send us any comments about this podcast on Twitter, you can tweet at me. I'm at AC Mazzaro. You can tweet at Josh. He's at Round Howard. Mike is at A Mike Bloom Type. And Kurt is at Kurt Clark. And you can use the hashtag Top Chef Flyover if you want to remark about this specific podcast episode. You can also, as Mike indicated, leave us comments at robhasawebsite.com in the Reality Rehapups section where our Top Chef podcasts are located. We'll have the page up for this individual episode with the links to the interview from She Knows, with Philip, with the links to the Up Rocks article, and with a comment section there. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back next week to talk about David Copperfield or whatever other magic crops up on Top Chef. Take care.